Éclairage. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Académie. On retrouve Marianne Durand-Lacaze.
Good afternoon, Professor Yasuaki Onuma. I'm very honored to have you here today on Canal Académie. Bonjour et bienvenue.
Thank you very much. Je suis très heureux here in Canal Académie.
Thank you very much. Yasuaki Onuma, you are a professor to the University of Tokyo, where you teach law and politics. You were a visiting professor at the University of Columbia, at the Institut Universitaire des Hautes Études Internationales, at the University of Michigan and in Paris One University and in Beijing University as well, among other places. Your research and educational subjects are international law and politics in international society, international human rights law, comparative civilization. Your other topics are law, culture and society, and cultural imperialism, United Nations, and the comparative study of immigration system. Among your major publications, the Tokyo War Crime Trials and also the book entitled A Normative Approach, Peace, War and Justice in Yugoslavia. So thank you again for being here with us. All the more so as you have just given your second lecture at the Collège de France. I hope you have enjoyed the walk from the college to the institute, from the prestigious Sorbonne to the banks of the Seine, opposite the Louvre Museum. Your two conferences, what were they about, Professor?
Well, I have enjoyed giving two lectures at Collège de France very much, especially I have used a number of mangas, cartoons, and which attracted, apparently, many audience. And I believe manga and animation are a very good form and leading form of culture in the contemporary civilization, global civilization. And people reacted very favorably to my lectures, both in terms of theory and practice, because human rights occupies such an important position in the contemporary world.
Professor Yasuaki Onuma, do you think that the system of sovereign states is obsolete considering the globalization of economy and information? What is your vision, and let's have a modest prospective vision, even if it's not easy, how could the 21st century evolve?
Well, on the one hand, certainly the system of sovereign state is being eroded by the globalization of economy and information. But also we have to remember the fact that for the most developing countries, the 21st century is a century of nation building. For developed countries like Western European countries and Japan, the United States, 20th century or late 19th century were the era of nation building. Therefore, statism prevailed in those areas. Whereas in the 21st century, for the majority of human species, the developing countries' people, it is the era of nation building. So even in the 21st century, the sovereign state system will not disappear. It will continue to exist as a very important element of the global society.
Professor Yasuaki Onuma, in the lectures that you gave the last 2 weeks at the Collège de France, you emitted the idea that since the late 20th century, the concept of the propagation of Western modernity has changed. So you point out new sort of conflicts which disturb the international order. Could you tell us more about those conflicts?
Well, in my view, there are basically three conflicts which we have to be prepared for confronting. The first is a conflict between, as I have just said, the sovereign state system on the one hand, and the globalization of economic and information. And sovereign state system has been subject to attack by global actors of multinational enterprises and the dissemination of globalized media agencies. But on the other hand, as I have said, developing countries stick to the system of sovereign state because for them, the major task is nation building, and sovereign state system is a good tool for them. And secondly, there's a conflict between a kind of a universalistic pursuit of an ideal or ideals, mainly conducted by developed countries in terms of human rights and the protection of global environment. Because people in the developed countries have reached the stage of a high standard of living, so economic profits, interests do not so attract people. But more humanitarian or human rights associated ideas and ideals attract people. But for those who are in developing countries, the situation is different. And they still have vivid memory of being subjugated to colonial system of Western powers and to a certain extent Japan. And they have been subject to racial discriminations, and they have had a kind of a sense of humiliation.
Yes.
So this universal pursuit for human dignity and their sense of humiliation and victimization sometimes conflict.
Yeah.
And thirdly, there's a conflict between the power of ideas and information held by Western countries, our space of discourse and cognitive framework, are very West-centric, but the actual power in terms of economics, Asian nations are having more and more stronger influence in global society. So there will be major conflicts between those Western countries who still hold a tremendous power, soft power of information and intellectuality, and the hard power of economics held by Asian nations. So we have to be prepared to these three types of conflicts in this century.
You mentioned a feeling of humiliation experienced by non-Western societies when Western societies put forward the international human rights law. How is this humiliation felt and used by states, NGOs, or multinational firms?
Well, I myself have been a human rights activist for more than 30 years, and I have seen many scenes that even a very legitimate criticism coming from human rights NGOs or international organizations or Western medias have been rejected, not only by elites in developing countries, but also ordinary citizens of those non-Western societies. And I think to recognize this fact, this is not just a political tool to be used by elites in the developing countries, I mean this sense of humiliation, but widely shared by the mass of non-Western societies is important. I do not deny that political elites of Asian and African countries have abused this sense of humiliation as a defense to avoid criticism. But on the other hand, we should not forget the other side of the story.
What solution would you propose to transcend this problem? Would a perspective help us understand better the complex problem of multipolar and multi-civilizational world?
Well, I think one of the most important tasks for us living in this 21st century is to try to persuade people to be prepared that we are entering the world of, as you have just said, the world of multipolarity and multi-civilizationality. Because people living in the 20th century have been so accustomed to the West-centric construct of the world, we simply forget this fact. For example, today I wear Western suits and Western tie, and we live according to Christian calendar, and we communicate in English or in French. All these are Western products, and people take these for granted, but this might be uncomfortable, for example, for Indians or for Chinese, who have had a very long history of civilizations.
As you said in your conference and at the Collège de France, and now we have somewhat adopted this trans-civilizational cognitive framework, Professor Yasuo Kilnuma. Could you explain, please, again, take an example?
Yes. Well, one of the
For the European,
for example. Yes. I have just started to say it, to refer to Europeans. Today, Europeans live basically according to the way of thinking and patterns of behavior, which is essentially modern Western, which is, from the perspective of religion, secular. But on the other hand, most Europeans unconsciously adopt words, behavior, ceremony originating from Christianity. At the same time, most Europeans, especially those in Western Europe, are living a very luxurious life of mass production, mass consumption, and mass waste, which should be characterized as American way of life, a typical 20th century American civilization. In addition, most European children watch TV and unconsciously are much influenced by Japanese culture because most animation films and mangas are originating from Japan, and Japanese influence has been tremendous. So in this sense, most Europeans belong to different civilizations simultaneously. So we are all, in this sense, multiple existence in terms of cultures and civilization. We should not stick to the concept of culture or civilization, which is exclusive.
What are the advantages and the drawbacks of what you call the West-centered system?
Well, West-centric system has brought a number of values and virtues and in profits to humanity. And we have been liberated from the domination of religion and male-centered institutions and feudalism, etc. But on the other hand, the West-centric way of thinking and life have brought a kind of a very legalistic and individualistic way of life to society, which sometimes may contribute to sharpening the confrontational culture in societies and alienation of people from family relations, more intimate communal relations, etc. And secularization, in a sense, the modernity, West-centric modernity, killed the God. So we live in a secular world. But without this belief in supernatural being, people have lost a very definite guide, and people are at a loss what to do.
Human rights are already considered as legitimate at the global level. The 1993 Vienna Declaration, the pact in 1966, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, and then before that, the American Declaration of Independence, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. All that is full of meaning to our listeners in France and elsewhere, probably. Mm-hmm. What is the judicial and historical interest in of the Vienna Declaration of 1993?
Well, in my view, the importance of the Vienna Declaration of 1993 has been underestimated. Most people know the Universal Declaration on Human Rights of 1948. This is the most famous instrument in the field of human rights. And many people know French Declaration of 1789 and the American Declaration of Independence, but few people know the Vienna Declaration of 1993. But in fact, the Vienna Declaration of 1993 is important for various reasons. First, it is an agreement between 171 nations compared with some 150 nations signatories of the International Covenants on Human Rights of 1966 and 40 nations agreeing to the Universal Declaration of 1948. And other historical documents, those of national instruments rather than international instruments. And secondly, in terms of the content, the Vienna Declaration, because of its most recent promulgation, has far more well-balanced in their appreciation of various kinds of human rights, not only civil and political rights, but also economic, social, and cultural rights. And you could also say that this declaration was a product not only the process of negotiation between governments about 1,500 NGOs watched the negotiation process of this Vienna Declaration, and they very actively proposed some revisions and alterations, and some of their proposals were well taken. For example, the right of women to strengthen the meaning of this proposition was accepted. And thirdly, the Vienna Declaration was a product after a fierce controversy between those who argue very different perspectives in terms of culture, religion, and civilizations. In early 1990s, there was a discussion on so-called Asian values or Asian human rights, which challenged the universality of human rights understood in the Western manner. And this argument was very politicized and abused, but nevertheless, its historical meaning to doubt the universality of the pre-existing human rights instruments was very important. And the Vienna Declaration was a result of those intergovernmental negotiations with the help of NGOs, and after the fierce controversies in terms of religions and cultures. And it represents the global consensus at the end of the 20th century. So its global legitimacy is very, very high.
Human rights were born in modern Europe, but have there existed other areas of the world?
Well, quite a number of people have argued that human rights or democracy or rule of law existed in other civilizations. But even in Europe, during the pre-modern period, human rights did not exist. There existed privileges and special rights of some groups, for example, the rights and privileges of clergy or nobles or merchants, those established classes, they did exist. But the human rights per se, human rights themselves as an abstract right of human being, did not exist even in Europe during pre-modern period. And other civilizations had a kind of a functional equivalent of human rights in each civilization, but not human rights itself.
What is the safest way to put an end to the theory of the clash of civilization?
Well, the most important thing for us to understand is, as I suggested, that civilization is not a monolithic entity to which a human belongs to in an exclusive manner. Rather, we should understand the concept of civilization in a more functional way so that it allows us to understand that we all belong to several civilizations simultaneously. So, as a Japanese, I love operas, and I love tangos and waltz, and I speak English. I studied, for example, Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, Marx, more than maybe Confucius and some other Oriental thinkers. But I also, of course, love Japanese foods and Japanese culture and Chinese civilization. So, like Europeans, everyone in the world belong to several civilizations simultaneously. So it's nonsensical to talk about clash of civilizations. It is a consequence of substantiation of the concept of civilization.
You mention international standards, but only trans-civilizational perspective. Do you think we could one day define trans-civilizational standards? We will speak about trans-civilizational law and not international law any longer.
Well, I do not necessarily think that the trans-civilizational perspective overrides, supersedes international perspective. International perspective and transnational perspective and trans-civilizational perspectives, they are a kind of a cognitive and evaluative frameworks, and they can coexist. So even in international treaties, international agreements, we can find some trans-civilizational elements. For example, if we compare the Universal Declaration of 1948 and the Vienna Declaration of 1993, in terms of trans-civilizationality, the Vienna Declaration is more advanced because it was adopted in the period when most Afro-Asian nations attained independence already, whereas the Universal Declaration of 1948 was adopted when many Asian and African people were under colonial rule. So there were fewer rooms for them to promulgate their ideas, their cultures, their civilizational perspectives than the case of the Vienna Declaration. So we can use trans-civilizational perspective as a way of seeing and judging existing things together with international perspectives, which tend to be state-centric or government-centric.
Professor Numa, let me thank you for this interview on Canal Academy, the web radio of the five academies of l'Institut de France. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. And I apologize that I could not accept this interview in French because of my poor French. But I have enjoyed this interview very much. Merci beaucoup.
It was a pleasure for us.